Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Action Radio. This is Greg Penglis coming to you from the historic district of downtown Milton on the banks of the beautiful Blackwater River. And now let's get into Action Radio. So did you miss me? I'm back. It's fascinating, to actually take a day off and wake up on a Monday, about 2 hours after the show actually would have ended normally. I'm going, wow, this is kind of cool. I get a day off. But then I thought, I really miss my show. And so it's nice to be back here. I had some time to go over some stuff, to think about things. And this has been in the back of my mind for a while as to how exactly to do a show around the World Trade Center buildings that didn't look like, a conspiracy theory, but actually challenged the current government dogma in a way that was scientific. I mean, real science, not just made up stuff that comes out of the government, because all this stuff is so, agenda driven anyway, that you can't believe, much of anything. I mean, you look at vaccines, you look at the World Trade Center, you look at anything they do for our security, it turns out to be for their security, or their riches or things like that. But the other problem is, of course, when you challenge the conventional story, the liberals come out saying, hey, you sound like a conspiracy theorist. I don't want to be a conspiracy theorist. I don't want to talk about facts. This sounds like one of the Rush Limbaugh characters he used to drag up. Yeah, Mr. Liberal. Okay, you sound like this. Okay, fine. And those voices are out there. They're Karens and Metrosexual Mike and all the other – well, I just made that up. But, all the other folks out there that would look at you going, you're a conspiracy theorist. Well, like that's supposed to be some kind of insult. It's like calling you a racist. Okay, well, let's get around all the crap and the name-calling, and let's actually find out what happened. And so the basic question I was asking, and we'll be asking in the second hour especially, is does it make sense that airplanes would hit the top of a building and it would collapse from the bottom? Now, to me, it makes no sense whatsoever, which is why I'm asking the question. But that's the thing we're going to kind of take a look at. We'll look at it from several angles. And the thing that really shoots this whole argument in the foot and the thing that you don't hear about very often is building number 7, because building number 7 also came down and nothing hit it, nothing at all. So you've got a perfectly good World Trade Center building that collapses from the bottom, a lot like a demolition charge would do. In fact, exactly like a demolition charge would do, and yet nothing hit it. But the official story is, well, debris from building from Tower 1 or Tower 2 hit World Trade Center 7. No, it didn't. So this goes on, and the story goes on, and I figure the 20th anniversary is the perfect time to talk about it. So this is 9/7. So this is 4 days before 9/11, and as we prepare for the unfortunate and possibly likely terrorist attack that's going to happen, since Biden let in 100 to 200,000 Afghani stowaways as opposed to taking out Americans, anything's possible. But it's really, we really need to look at this. And there, of course, the resulting deep state, power state, security state that emerged from 9/11 that was amazingly convenient. The bill's already written and ready to go. So with that, let's get to a few minutes with Gene Vernig, our producer, and find out your take on this or anything else you want to talk about until we get into our cruise and travel with Shelby. Gene, good morning.
Hey, good morning. Yeah, it was interesting. I was talking to someone yesterday about something I heard, and I just – with all the people coming in and you don't know which ones are here because they want to be here and they want to get away from their circumstances and which ones are here because of just things they plan on doing. And the person that I was listening to said, it may not even happen now, may not happen this year, but they are putting plans in place for something to happen. And I was like, wow, I didn't even think of what's to come. I was just thinking of more the imminent future. But the sad thing is with what you're saying with the World Trade Center and that it makes sense. I'm not an engineer. I don't understand all that stuff. However, that is pretty amazing, isn't it, to think how it went down. And the circumstances behind it, we're never going to know the truth either, which is really
sad.
I
don't know about that. I think people may never accept the truth. The government officials may never, acknowledge the truth, because to do so would be to acknowledge their complicity in it. And so I think as I'm rapidly coming to the conclusion that, as I stated in a previous show, the government comes up with the policy first, with the agenda first, and then they create the the story behind it, and then they create the evidence to back up their conclusion. But they always start with the conclusion, whereas a private, like a doctor, for example, who like Dr. Salenko, when he tried to treat patients, he was just looking for what worked. You know, it came to coronavirus. And he did his research. He looked around. He found that there was a study, you know, in France with Dr. Didier Raoult, who came up with the fact that chloroquine kills COVID. It's like, hey, this is good stuff. You know, and then, of course, he piggybacked on that and then added his own, the azithromycin and the zinc. And they found that together, it was an incredible combination. And a lot of folks have picked up on that as well, throughout the country. And so this has been fascinating. But when it comes to the buildings themselves, you know, a lot of engineers have had a look at it, but you've got to get away from the government engineers, because the government is going to give you the same story. Same thing with the climate scientists. They are paid to tell you the government agenda. They are paid to come up with evidence that backs the government agenda. You know, the predictions for COVID by Neil Ferguson in England was paid to come up with, you know, horrible numbers. I mean, that's his job. That's what he does. He's a government, you know, notoriously bad model maker who creates models to get government policy. And the people that created our security state love the fact that 9/11 allowed them to bring about the Patriot Act, you know, wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and all the stuff we're seeing today. And then you look at the fact that they've created a situation so bad in Afghanistan that everybody's calling for us to go back, especially Leon Panetta. It's like the conclusion was, let's go back. Well, how do we go back? We created withdrawal so bad that Americans are disgusted and want to go back. Okay. It was what, remember, the congressional candidate, Jerome Bell was talking about. You know, he said World War II, they knew Pearl Harbor was going to be attacked. Gulf of Tonkin, they knew that was going to happen in Vietnam. These are government set up things where they know it's going to happen. Now, did they know about 9/11? I have no idea. We knew the FBI knew that flight instructors, such as myself, you know, although this was after my time as a flight instructor, but had I been in the same situation, I know I would have reported, I got a bunch of Arabs here that want to learn how to fly an airplane, but they don't want to learn how to land. This seems a little unusual to me. Okay. I would have gone to the FAA first and then gone from there. So the evidence was there. Now, whether they chose to ignore it or not, or take it, apparently they chose to ignore it. So was that negligence? Was that stupidity? Or was that by design that somewhere along the way, someone knew this was going to happen and they stopped it? You know, the questions are endless, and this is what makes it so fascinating. In fact, we got Shelby listening on the line now, too. I'll bring her in a little bit. But, you know, if you look at – and I've got the most authoritative articles I could find by engineers, by non-U.S. government engineers. I think the World Trade Center 7 studies by Canadians, and I've got – I don't know. I'll check again when I pull up the article in the next hour on the author who said that it's a mathematical impossibility that airplanes crashing into the top of a highly engineered skyscraper that's engineered for fire, that's engineered for earthquakes, that's engineered for wind and harmonics and shakes and is weaker at the top, stronger at the bottom, so it will actually shake. It has give to it. It's got all these incredible engineering factors all fit in, would suddenly crash from the bottom, you know, when hit at the top, when there's no evidence the fire from the top reached the bottom. That just seems to me irrational. That's as irrational as thinking that Flight 800 just suddenly broke apart when no 747 has broken apart like that before. It makes sense that was a missile. And you listen to Jack Cashel will tell you exactly the same thing. And I know a little bit about airplanes, you know, having taught people how to fly them. It's, you know, there's certain improbables that we wonder about. And if you question it, you're called a conspiracy theorist. Well, that's just a way to shut you up. Well, I'm not going to be shut up. You know, I'm not going to go quietly on this one. We're going to find out. We're going to keep going. And it may take, we still don't know the full impacts of the Kennedy assassination. Although the papers are supposed to come out 75 years later, but who knows if they're going to. We don't know yet. You know, so there's a lot of unknowns. But the main thing is to ask the questions. That's the most important thing. And using logic and reason, which is what we do on this show, using logic and reason, Gene, what does your logic and reason tell you about 9/11, about the World Trade Center towers?
That it isn't like it seems or what it looked like. That's not what actually happened.
Why do you think?
Because I think the government has a lot to do with a lot of things that goes on, but yet they cover their tracks.
Okay. So who would benefit from this? I'm sort of putting you on the spot here. you know, motive. If something's, yeah. if the government's going to do this, there must be a reason. So we got to figure out why. I think it's for the deep state, for the perpetration of power, in the same way that government has allowed wars to happen. If they knew about Pearl Harbor in advance, if they knew about Gulf of Tonkin, if they knew about the Maine, which started the Spanish-American War, if these things were designed, like Hitler burned the Reichstag, the parliament, in order to get Germany, you know, whipped up against Jews to start World War II. If governments use these pretenses, if the Lusitania got us into World War I, and it was, you know, was it allowed to be sunk? Was it obvious? Did they put Americans on that? I mean, the thing was armed with incredible amounts of arms, you know, and ammunition for World War I, you know, which is why the Germans sunk it. You know, I mean, are these things known? Are they designed? Or are these just complete accidents? That's the question. Yeah, it's a lot, isn't it?
All we can do is look at the information, come up with our own opinion of what happened or what is.
Yep, that's what we're going to do over the course of the show. Just to let you know, I just finished my Santa Rosa Volunteers piece for this the show about a minute before airtime. So try to imagine how much I was scrambling ahead of time. So again, things seem a little disorganized. It's like we're always on the edge here. And so it gets quite a bit crazy. All right, I got Shelby on the line. I'm going to play Shelby's theme here simply because, you know, I'll give Shelby the option to either get into travel or talk about what we've talked about here or any number of other things in the time that we have before Josie gets here. And she might just actually pick up on this because she's raised the 9/11 question several times on the show. And again, it's up to you guys. That's what makes it fun.
Yeah, man. Come with Shelby to faraway places. Wonderful beaches, exotic foods, meet new and fascinating people as Action Radio cruise and travel reporter Shelby Frenette takes you to where dreams become your reality and experiences become your best memories. Yeah, man. Here we go.
Good morning, Shelby.
Good morning.
Hi.
How's it going?
Well, it's our normal craziness. I've asked a huge question that can't be answered right away, which is pretty much normal. Oh, I want to take this note to let Shelby and Gene and everybody else know. We have a very special guest, a friend of Shelby's, who's going to be on tomorrow, Casey Plouffe. I hope I pronounced that right. If not, Shelby, correct me immediately. Casey's going to be on tomorrow in the second hour, and so it's going to be really, really fun to have her. She has a church. She has fascinating ideas, and we've had a chat off the air already. She's going to be a wonderful guest and I hope a regular part of Action Radio as time goes on. So she might even do, you know, pick up the Oh My God report again. So who knows what will happen? That's the beauty of this. We're all potential, all imagination. You know, anything is possible here, and that's why we do what we do. Shelby, did you want to – I know kind of catching you on the spot here. I don't know if you wanted to talk about World Trade Center or if you want to listen to the show, maybe comment at a later time or get right into what's happening at travel. So I leave that to you.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, you know, I don't really have enough background on the World Trade Center. I know, I think for most of us, it does seem unusual the way it went down, and there are some real big questions, but I just don't have enough background in order to speak to that with any authority. But I will say Casey, by the way, is huge proponent of health and naturopath, and she and her church actually don't allow, they have an actual opportunity where they don't allow things in their bodies. So for religious reasons, the people that are part of that church, I don't believe have to be vaccinated. They have those religious exemptions. And I think most of the states do allow the religious exemptions for vaccination, with exception of New York, California, and maybe Connecticut. I can't remember which one. There's like three of them. But she's pretty fascinating individual and has been on a journey as well. So I hope you guys enjoy her, and we'll learn more, because I really don't know too much more than that about what she's up to. But
we'll let her tell us. Everybody can tell their own story.
That's a
good part. Yeah.
She'll tune in. But it's, you know, she's always a couple steps ahead. And her husband is also into a lot of the Second Amendment rights proponent. So it's pretty
fascinating. Yeah, he should call Friday during our gun report with Jim Dykes, who's the director of Florida Carry, hoping to get open carry and constitutional carry to our state so we don't have to ask our government permission to do what we could do anyway. And so that's going to be fascinating.
Well,
so we should tell him about that. Yeah.
You could, you can mention that to her as well. But anyway, as far as travel goes, not much has changed in the sense that, you know, the restrictions are still all there. I will say, I think kind of like people didn't realize in Canada how it was completely locked down, and they won't even allow you into the country without a vaccine right now. We had some colleagues of ours try to get into Canada, and they hadn't been vaccinated at least 14 days. They were turned away at the border. So I don't think people realize how incredibly stringent it is. And the UK area is also incredibly stringent. Just a few days ago, they say that any non-UK resident from a red list country, which is basically any country that has some COVID numbers, will undergo a 10-day hotel quarantine at their own expense. And it starts at about £2,300. And anyone dodging the quarantine risks a fine up to £10,000. And the residents that are vaccinated via the UK vaccine program, who are returning to England, Scotland, Wales, Northern Ireland from an amber country, they don't need to quarantine. So again, you know, there's it's all pretty much in the system. And I think, you know, it's a little different than it is here because you still have kind of debates going on, you know, whether or not people want to be vaccinated, where as people there don't have choice.
Question on the national health care plans. Both England and Canada have socialized medicine. You are dependent on your government for your health care. Now, are these governments making restrictions on the people? Is anybody being denied government health care because of not getting a vaccine? Are they that coercive? Because they certainly could be. I think they would hear, given Dr. Fascist.
I have not heard of any incidents like that, but I also want to make sure that the mindset is understood that everyone I've spoken to, and I mean, I'm sure there's a few, there's always, you know, a different opinion somewhere, but the majority of the UK residents, the majority of the Canadian residents that I've spoken to and listened to are very, very much behind getting the vaccine. So you don't have this kind of pushback that you see in the United States, and I'm not even sure if there is anywhere else that has any pushback on the vaccine. The residents are very much very much interested in getting the vaccine. They want it, so they aren't there to. They are under the mindset that it's a great idea, and they can't wait to get it in their system quicker. So you're not going to probably need this evasion technique because the majority are not evading. You know what I mean? They're happy to get it. So
They don't have the same. I don't think they have the same information sources. I mean, I don't know how much the government controls the press there. I know that if the government could, they would control it here, but we have laws against that. So they rely on big tech to do their dirty work for them. And that's why you'll see all the stories being censored on Facebook. That's why when I do a vaccine report, I call it the Not Ready for Facebook Vaccine Report, because most of the stuff I talk about would get me censored yet again, you know, on Facebook. But the thing is, the truth is the truth. And we've got doctor after doctor. It's like you and I live in two different worlds, okay? So in my world, you know, the cures are far better than the vaccine. The vaccine people, those who are vaccinated are shedding spike proteins. They're actually making other people sick with COVID, but as well as themselves, that all the variants are the result of the vaccines because there were no variants until the vaccines, you know, came out. The Delta variant started in India as a result of a substandard cheap Chinese vaccine because, hell, they don't care who they kill. They kill their own people. They don't give a damn about anybody else. And so that's my world. My world is the cure. My world is the fact that this is 99%, you know, all the things we've gone over, you know, 99%, you're not going to be affected by this. Most people, the vast majority of people, especially kids, you know, are going to have real no effect of this. They might even know they've had it. Everybody's already been exposed to this. And I reported that back in March of 2020 from a congressional briefing where they had a vaccine expert who was a former U.S. health official who went to work for a Japanese pharmaceutical, you know, for the money. It's usually where these people go back into private industry, reported that everybody gets exposed. That's how viruses work. You know, you look at a ship, you know, a place you're familiar with. If it's got norovirus, everybody's going to be exposed. Now, how many get sick is a different story. hopefully very few. But exposure and sickness are totally different things. So in the United States, we've got 330 million people, pretty much all of which, except the most vulnerable who we protected, have been exposed. But they don't get sick. In fact, very few. And those that died generally had comorbidities, that all kinds of other things going on. So in my world, it's very simple that there's no reason for a vaccine when we have the cures, when most people aren't affected by this anyway, when it's so simple to protect yourself with the basic ingredients of the cure, only a lesser amounts of it. And so the whole idea of pumping an experimental vaccine, and all the vaccines out there are still experimental. The approved one hasn't been made, won't be made for another 3 years at least. You know, that's a bait and switch. That's a fraud. So you look at all the frauds that are out there, all the fake information, all the stuff that's out there that people are willingly swallowing up because that's all they're getting. They're missing the other half of the information that I have, that there's no reason for any of this. It's created as a marketing tool to make big health and big government health rich and powerful in terms of lockdowns, mask mandates, and all the other stupid things they don't need, because we know the masks don't work. We know the lockdowns don't work. In fact, nothing works. The best thing they could have done is nothing. If they'd done nothing, this thing would have been gone by July. There would be no variants. That's my world. And yet you and I have such totally conflicting views of this simply because our sources of information are different. And the people that you talk to don't know what I know. And the people that I talk to don't care about what the people that you know think. It's this very, very strange world that we live in. But that's the separation.
I totally don't agree with that. The separation is so interesting to me because I'm not even close to against you guys. But because I challenge any of you, there's always an assumption that that's what I believe. And I always find that fascinating. I am under the belief that just talking to 10 people that believe the same thing isn't very productive. But being able to come up with ways to shake the masses' beliefs and inject really good information is the way to make any difference. Otherwise, you're just spending time on a soapbox, you know, where there could be so much more power. So when I am challenging anyone here on the show, it's more because you have to be able to have this discussion and get the information across in a way that will be accepted by others, or they will not. They only see the black and white. They only see the conspiracy theorists and the people that are normal. And that's all I'm trying to get across is that.
No, that's an interesting division.
What is the masses? What is it going to take for the masses? It's going to take something much bigger from a government standpoint instead of just little pointed bullets with loaded information. And the information, I think everybody needs to hold themselves to a very high standard that is on your side, because there are people that just want to poke holes in your theories. So, for example, last week, when anyone says something like, oh, you know, I was cured by this, that is just like all of a sudden – anyone that you're speaking to now is not going to believe the rest of what you say, because you just said something that isn't true. Just the same on the other opposite side.
Wait. Hold on. Why would you think it's not true that people are cured? Joe Rogan and Kirstie Alley were just cured. Neither of them have had, well, I know Joe Rogan hasn't had a vaccine. I think he took ivermectin. I think Kirstie Alley took hydroxychloroquine. They're both cured. No hospital, no nothing. I think within 48 to 72 hours, both of them were up and running again.
Scientifically, you can't, unless you have a study being controlled, there's no way to know, because if you didn't take the things that you took, then you might be also cured. So you don't know what the end result would be. It's really that simple. You just don't know.
Actually, you do know. You do know, because there are hundreds of studies. Here's the problem, though. The two sets of information that we're talking about, see, I think what's frustrating, I'm not against you personally, obviously not. I love having you on the show, and I love the disagreement, and that's fine. But what I am frustrated with, and I think a lot of people who are looking at the information in depth as we are doing here on this show, is that we're beating our heads against the wall trying to get the information to the folks that are only getting the government, you know, induced perspective. They don't know that there are cures. They don't know that the vitamins will help you. They don't know that hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin destroy the protein and that the zinc then kills the genetic material of the virus. They don't know those simple things. They don't know that 99% of the population is already immune to this thing simply through either they get it and they get over it, or they have an immune system where they never get it in the first place. There are so many things that aren't known. And I think the frustration is we can't get that information to the folks that think the vaccine is wonderful because they're just not allowing that information to come in. So I can say that these cures do work. I can say there are hundreds of studies. I can say all these things because I've looked at them. Okay. And I'm not the only one. There are thousands of doctors and thousands.
People that have taken the same exact regimen that you're talking about and not been cured. So
Did they have other problems? Were they at the short end of life anyway? Were they morbidly obese? Did they have cancer, heart disease, and who knows what else? See, the problem is you really have to look at these issues closely. It's like when they did studies in The Lancet and the New England Journal of Medicine, they sabotaged the studies on hydroxychloroquine to prove that it didn't work. They either gave enough to kill people, which you give enough of any drug to kill people, it's going to, or they gave it so late that it wasn't going to have any effect anyway. Everybody knows who knows this issue knows that ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine really have to be given in the first week of infection. Because starting around day 8, 9, et cetera, it just gets worse and worse and worse. And you get the cytokine storm where your own immune system tears you apart, thinking that you're the disease rather than the actual virus. This is the problem as to what happens with this stuff. Now, I don't know all the mechanics of it either. I'm not a doctor. But I know enough to know the studies that I've read and the things I've looked at that it makes sense to me from a logic and reason point of view that the cure is a whole lot better than the vaccine, that the immunity is a whole lot better than the vaccine. In fact, anything's better than the vaccine simply because it's making people way too rich. There's so much corruption in it. And the fact that they want to restrict the information on it rather than have an open debate tells me that they've got something to hide. And that's where the problem comes in. Censorship. If it was open debate, I wouldn't have a problem. It's not an open debate.
I agree with you completely on censorship. We're not even allowed to like talk about cures when we're in a nutrition company. And the word cure, again, that is such a buzzword that almost when someone says something's a cure, you almost don't believe the rest of what they say, period.
Why?
So because it has to work 100% of the time, and it doesn't. And to answer your question,
I mean, I don't think most people don't believe that. Well, no, but the cures are different for different people. I mean, I'll tell you another one that's fascinating, and I'm going to get you in the conversation here really quick too. But the latest controversy over ivermectin, they say it's a horse pill. Well, the animal form of it, yes, it is, but the human form of it is for people. But there's human grade ivermectin and there's animal grade ivermectin. And I bet you if we do a little bit of research, we can find hundreds of drugs that have both a human and an animal form simply because most of the animals, like the farm animals, are mammals. They're not that far removed from us. Horses, cows, and pigs, operate on a pretty similar life system as do people. However, we're different. That's why we don't eat dog food. because we're different, right? And probably because dog food is horrible for most dogs, let alone people. But the question is, if you can distinguish between human, it's like fluoride. Okay, people say, well, you can't put fluoride in the water. Well, industrial waste product fluoride, no. But when you go to the dentist and when you get in your toothpaste, that's pharmaceutical grade fluoride. It's an entirely different product. Yet they're both called fluoride. So we really have to be specific when we talk about these things. Otherwise, the debate gets lost, and it's too easy to convince people. Well, you don't want to take a horse dewormer.
All I'm trying to help you do is make sure you get your message more listened to, because once you start saying the word cure, the people that you might have educated are tuning you out completely and putting you in a category of people that they don't know anything because you're not a doctor. So I'm trying to help you. And I know how to deliver information to people so that they're receptive. And I think your goal is to educate people that are not on not listening to both sides of the story, And so you have to think about your delivery of acceptance, because there are triggers that will stop people from listening. And they will put you in a category of crazy person. And, conspiracy theorists very quickly. So there's a way to deliver information. You have a lot of great information, but it's important for people not to come on and just pretend like they are doctors. It's a cure. To answer your question, which I'd like to, these people that my girlfriend had, her whole entire family got infected, they were on the whole regimen of zinc and vitamin D, and they were on the regimen. They all still got it except for the mom. She's the only one who didn't get it. But the whole family, she had, trumped them all up, and I meant to say brought a lot of the same information. It had nothing to do with Trump. I'm sorry. It's such a trigger word for a lot of people.
I don't know why. He's a great president.
Yeah, put them all. Yeah. had put them together for her family. So they still got it, and they did take the hydroxychloroquine. I don't know about the ivermectin, but that didn't help either, or it didn't cure them, let's say.
What did?
And they were hospitalized, and they didn't have one of them was older. The mother-in-law was older, and she was very sick. She didn't die, so that's great. But nobody knows if that helped, if it didn't help. You know, I've taken hydroxychloroquine when I was in Mexico. I don't know if it helped. I didn't get the COVID, so that's good.
Did you get malaria?
But,
it's usually what it's for. It's usually for malaria when you go to different countries,
And I don't know if it worked, but I know I definitely did enough research to say it was worth trying. The risk-reward ratio was a good risk-reward ratio for me personally in my health position. But would I go around telling people that it stopped me from getting it? No, because I don't know that. I don't know that. So I think the delivery, when I say that to someone, they actually listen to me. When someone comes on and says, it cured me, they go, okay, well, then that's a Fruit Loop. So just to get your message across a little bit more effective, are willing, are finally willing to listen instead of just being in the same boat. That if you're just going to preach to the choir, how impactful is that? You know, so that is when I challenge anyone, it's not that I am on a different side so much as to understand that you've got very valuable information. I would just, in Josie's case specifically, be more mindful of these buzzwords because people aren't listening after that. They're just not. They are not.
Yeah, no, I understand that. And
you know,
Josie
so
and I have words about this. Yeah. But here's the problem. I just want to jump in here for a second because, you know, in criticizing my message, you're actually bringing up a lot of things that are techniques to destroy arguments, you know, on you know, my particular side of this. When you say that, you know, you talk about a cure, well, there are cures. Okay. When you say that people aren't listening because they think you're a conspiracy theorist, and that's a way to categorize and demonize people so that the messenger is being demonized rather than the message. The message may be perfectly good, but if you start saying, well, you're a conspiracy theorist, you know, that's just a way to shut people up. It's like calling them a racist, okay, when there's no basis for that whatsoever, but it suits not you specifically, but it suits the political agenda of those who want to shut other people up. And so it's very dismissive. It's very, it's almost condescending in a way, not you, but this argument that's been used to say that, well, you know, no one's going to listen to you because you're not an expert, okay? Well, if you look at the great experts, you know, if you look at every drug that the FDA recalled, they initially approved it, and that was done by experts. You know, if you look at pretty much everything that's happened, the bridges that have collapsed were approved by experts, all right? So expert doesn't mean anything if it's someone with an agenda. So, yeah, we've got government experts that tell you that vaccines don't work, and yet they're making untold thousands, millions, who knows how many dollars off vaccines. You've got big tech experts that won't let, you know, this information on their platforms, yet they're invested heavily in those same pharmaceutical companies, and they're making billions of dollars. So an expert has to be impartial in what they're saying. And you look at someone like Dr. Zelenko, who's now a friend of mine, who came up with a protocol that does cure people and that has given it to the president. We could have stopped COVID in about 3 weeks if the 60 million tablets of hydroxychloroquine that Peter Navarro was ready to distribute around the country had been distributed. We wouldn't have a pandemic now. In fact, we probably never would have had a pandemic. Okay, but that kind of information, you say, well, you're a conspiracy theorist. You're a quack. You don't know what you're talking about. You're not a doctor. I don't have to be a doctor to read the studies. I don't have to be a doctor to analyze the motivations of the people that are trying to hurt me. I don't have to be an expert to know that the experts, so-called, the technocrats, the bureaucrats, that sort of merging of bureaucracy and technology, and that's what we call a technocrat, are in it for their own selfish reasons. I don't have to be an expert to know that Dr. Fascist, who we affectionately call Dr. Fauci around here, the genocidal psychopathic drug pusher, has about 1,000 patents of both viruses and vaccines. He's making money on both ends of that. So you're going to take his word for it? Okay, if you take an X, I want to know their motivations. I want to know their incentives. I want to know what makes them work and where they're benefiting from this. And if you can take that away and you can show me that they don't have any conflicting things in their background that's going to cause them to go a certain way with their, quote, expertise, then I might listen to them. So in the same way as folks that you know are dismissing me for being, quote, a conspiracy theorist, which they label conveniently so they don't have to listen to me, I'm going to take their experts and do the same thing to them and say, you got to prove to me this expert actually is genuine, that doesn't have a conflict of interest, that isn't in it for their own personal gain. And if you can do that, then maybe I'll listen to them. And that's the other side of that argument.
No, I love that. I think that's a great opener that for people to consider different sides. You know,
okay.
The FDA.
Let's get them on the
general,
show. Let's get your friends on the show. I want to know the people that think I'm a conspiracy theorist. Bring them on. Go ahead, Shelby.
The FDA for sure. Like I always tell people, it's such a sad thing to watch. Honestly, what they've people from Monsanto that have ended up being on the board of the FDA. It's
how about
a sad,
that?
Sad thing to watch.
Yeah.
And you know, the FDA's first priority might have at one point been our safety. I think that legitimately that was probably the initial reasoning for it. And then, you know, it's become secondary and third, and the first is always primary money. You know, I work in a nutritional company as well. I've been a part of for at least 5 years, and it's interesting to me that we have the most stringent regulations on what we are allowed to say, even though it's supposedly free speech, and I can't tell my story. I cannot tell you how much healthier I am and what my blood was like after doing, you know, my blood work was like after doing a cleanse on my system. I can't even tell you that because the company is watching what I write and everybody, and there's hundreds of thousands of people in this company. I don't know how they can figure out the AI on this, but they actually message me and tell me to pull things down because they're such a high awareness of the FDA watching them, and they know that the FDA doesn't allow anyone to make any claims about anything that is not FDA approved, and they still haven't approved natural things, which is
of course not.
Right. Well,
so I'll tell you why. Because Big Pharma runs the FDA. Big Pharma contributes most of the money that the FDA operates under with their drug trials. The FDA is basically the recruiting service for Big Pharma that, as you said before, and rightly so, most of the top executives of the FDA end up working for the drug companies. So they're not going to ruin their chance to work for a big pharmaceutical by regulating a big pharmaceutical in the way they don't want. And guess who has more money? The nutrition companies, the vitamin supplement companies, or Big Pharma? I'll give you like 2 seconds. It's Big Pharma. That's why nutrition companies don't get approved. It's that simple.
But that's something that I think people really do not understand for the most part. And I say they're asking the wrong questions. Why isn't there any differentiating information on the media instead of, you know, asking why is the FDA might be bad, just why aren't we able to get balanced information? That would be the question that most people could start with that's not so overwhelming for them. And I think, you know, again, I ultimately, if we're just talking about travel, I have to say I don't feel like the temperature in the room is going anywhere but fully vaccinated in order to travel anywhere. In fact, you know, we're getting to the point where you have to be vaccinated to go to New York City and the restaurants and such. The vaccine passports, all the stuff that's already in the works in the UK, you know, they have electronic leashes on everyone now. And people for the most part are...
Think about what you just said. That's the key. It's got nothing to do with the vaccines. It's electronic leashes on everyone. Now you're getting somewhere. In the same way that 9/11 got us the Patriot Act, COVID has got us the medical restrictions where we can be tracked everywhere we go because of these stupid, illegal, unconstitutional vaccine passports. That is fascinating.
Yeah. Well,
let's get Jean in here.
I
want to get Jean back here. She's been patiently waiting.
I feel like most people understand that's, you know, everything electronic is tracking us more and more, but it does get...
Well, most people... How do you speak for most people? Do you talk to most people? I mean, you talk to some people, but, you know, the big... And I'm not criticizing you, but the generalization that's saying that, well, people feel this way, therefore you're wrong. Well, you don't know. You know, and it's like most people maybe that you've communicated with. I mean, I don't talk to most people. I talk to very few, actually. I wish I talked to millions more. We're working on that. But what it really comes down to is that it's the information we need to analyze, not the message or the amount of people listening, so we can try and get to the quality of it. But I want to get Jean in. Jean's been too patient here. Jean, this is for you guys to talk. I've been talking too much. Why don't you jump in?
Well, I just want to talk about the, you know, hydro... the HCL, the ivermectin, or I can't even say that word, and all those, and that they didn't cure the people from getting it. I don't think it is actually even meant to be cured, to prevent them. I think it's to keep them, one, to help them get better faster, and two, to prevent them from dying. And does it? Who knows? But I do know that I was a person I listened to on the internet. He got online last night and did a special program on a person from Tennessee that was put in the hospital, and his wife has tried to get him out of there because he did not want to be put on a respirator. They won't let him do anything. And then, you know, as far as the wife bring him anything in, and I know people are that are a lot, she's not able to see him anymore. So the thing is, I know people that are able to see their loved ones that have COVID, they've been putting the ivermectin, even the horse stuff, not taking it internally, but rubbing it on their legs or arms and stuff, and that seems to help, even just something like that. The thing is, when if they're having such a hard time breathing and stuff like that, what's the harm in at least giving them those things to see if it helps them, regardless if it does or not? One, they're very cheap compared to being put on a ventilator or compared to what they normally treat them with. But the thing is, why don't they even try? Because there are people that say it's helped them. And no, is it going to prevent people from getting it? No. But I think if you look at the people out there, there's the people that get it versus the people that are put in the hospital, so many more people get it and they're okay. But it's those people that end up in the hospital. Why? I don't know what triggers in their body to make them have more difficulty with breathing and stuff like that. But it's like so many hospitals and doctors have said that they cannot give those medications or those things because they will lose their license. And isn't that sad?
It is sad. So, and that's a great question to pose too. And I think you posed a really another great question at one point. It's a very simple thing. But I think you said, like, when did you ever see doctors getting their licenses taken away for questioning something that they researched? You know, that's not a normal thing, and it's a really important question to pose to people, because it doesn't make any sense if your only argument is to, you know, de-license and censor everything that's on the other side of the argument, then it's not really a discussion at all, and that's very suspect. So it doesn't make any sense, and those are great questions to pose to people to hopefully start them thinking about other alternatives and that there are some other options, because what is the harm in trying when they're at that point? But they're not even allowed to try, you know, and it does not make sense. And actually, my girlfriend that had her whole family just recently out in the west coast of Florida that I was talking about, she said, honestly, they don't do anything for them. She goes, they gave them Tylenol, and basically one of her sister-in-law, who was in the worst shape, sent her home without even calling her to let her know, to an empty house, and she couldn't even walk with some car service. They just left her there. She couldn't get in the house. She wasn't even able to walk. She said, I can't even understand how these hospitals can treat people like this. She literally said, I think they're trying to kill them. That's what she said. And
funny
she's
you
like,
say
it
that.
Doesn't even what yeah. You know, because she couldn't get any information from anyone.
Yeah.
They wouldn't do
mm-hmm.
anything. They wouldn't do any of these treatments. Exactly what you're talking about, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
Those are great questions to pose to start those thought processes going. And now, I've not ever had good luck with most doctors, and I went into a natural, I'm not all natural or anything, but I've noticed that if you can give the body what it's lacking, most of the time the body will take care of a lot of the problems. And that is
right.
Not, you know, I've also been misdiagnosed quite a bit in Western medicine by doctors that I swear think they're smarter than anyone in the world, and
they're experts, Shelby.
Yeah,
right.
Those are the questions to pose, because I've already had my experiences. I know where I stand.
Mm-hmm.
I just would like to be able to help influence people on their terms, so that it's not just about spouting off little bullets at people, and let them sort of have the thought process themselves. It's just like telling your husband what to do. He won't do it, even if it's a good idea. You have to sort of make it their idea to figure out what they want to do that's going to be good. You know, it's not – people don't like to be told what to do. They don't like to be told. Like, even in network marketing, when we're – I know I have the best nutritional products on the planet. I know if you want to lose weight and feel great and have it easy and it's cheap as hell because, it, you know, if you're talking about per meal, I know it's the best value out there. But if I tell you it's the best, if they don't buy it from me, I have to educate them and let them see for themselves and ask questions and pose thoughts. And then they ask me, oh, well, let me, how do I sign up for that? Okay, well, now you've decided. It's your mind, your decision. So I think that is from last week. That's all I really wanted to point out is that I think you guys, especially everybody here that's so involved and putting so much time into it and educating yourselves and getting good factual information that's helpful, it's important to pose these questions so that they're accepted a little bit better in letting them come to these conclusions, because otherwise it's not as effective in the long term, in the big scheme of things. But
yeah.
That is my opinion, and I could be wrong. I have been wrong many times before.
You're absolutely you're brilliant in one regard, and I think this is one of the problems. And I got Josie in the line, so you're next. But the question is for those of us that learn from knowledge, that can read information and go, oh, that makes sense. I use logic and reason. I talk about that all the time on the show. But I think a lot of the folks that you're talking about, Shelby, learn from emotion. They have to feel good about it. They have to reach it on a gut level as opposed to an intellectual brain level. And I think those of us that look at things in terms of a logic and a reason point of view, who will take information and evaluate it and balance it against everything we know, as compared to those that think, well, and I don't understand the emotional level of learning because it just doesn't make sense to me. But yeah, I think you're absolutely right. You're speaking for the millions of people who do want things emotionally. And they have to feel good, that they have to warm up to something, that they have to feel comfortable with it. And then, so it's like they get the comfort from the emotion first, and then they look at the information. Whereas I look at the information first and then get comfortable from that. So it's like a totally inverse way of learning and accepting information. I think you're absolutely right. If you want to comment on that, and if you have to leave that, I understand. But then I want Josie.
Yeah,
she's online too. I want her to.
Okay. I would comment on it and just say that you got to take it from a place where these people have been, most people have only had a little limited time to listen to just the news station that comes through, you know, their restaurants, their TV, their radio. And so it's a long educational process in a different direction than what you have had. Mm-hmm. And what I have had, because I've traveled so much and seen so much that I would have been in the same boat as them, except for I happen to see and work with people from different countries that have turned my light on a little bit brighter. But I just think the majority of people are just not able. You have to warm up, like you said, warm them up. But thank you so much, guys. I'm Shelby. You're fabulous. Have an awesome day, and I will talk to you tomorrow. I'll be on to listen to Casey Plus and her sovereign church and hear what she's got for us. And thank you so much for having me. Bye-bye for now.
Oh, thank you.
Have a good
Shelby.
Day.
Like I say, I appreciate the disagreement and the facts that you have to bring to us, which is absolutely fascinating, even if I don't understand them all at the time. Josie, welcome to the conversation. I still don't have your theme yet. I'm working on it. It's been kind of
good morning.
Busy, as you can understand lately. Yeah.
Good morning.
Go ahead.
First of all, I want to say you're right on point with everything that you started since last March. And I've been sharing your videos, and your videos been helpful to so many people learning the truth with Dr. Salenko, Dr. Judy Mikovic, and everything that you're saying that nobody's listening to, she's wrong, completely wrong, 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 wrong.
Who, Shelby's wrong?
I'm shaking my head here. I don't believe. Yeah.
Well,
is.
I think we're onto something that like you and me and Jean, you know, we look at the information and then see if it fits, and then we get comfortable with it because it makes sense. Whereas
then,
a lot of people have to work on the emotions.
She's contradicting herself.
Yeah.
And then she's contradicting herself. They say, oh, they're killing people in the hospital. Anyway, that's another $100 we say in Spanish.
We'll do it. We'll do it again. I'm sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk 9/11
now,
or do you want to wait for the second hour? You can tell us what's happening.
If she got the vaccine, she's going to know the truth coming soon. So it's for all of you that got the vaccine. my niece was dying of cancer. She died last night.
Oh, I'm sorry.
40 years old.
Oh, wow.
Young girl.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She did not take the vaccine, so and he had COVID or anything like that. So well, I went to bed very late last night crying with the family.
Of course.
But anyway, yes, I wanted to talk about Haiti. Haiti's a mess.
Mm-hmm.
People are like confused. They don't know what to do. People with money in Haiti right now, they're stuck in food. If not, they're leaving the country. Thousands showed up at the American embassy a few days ago because Biden says that they will give him visa and all that, but they didn't do that. So they're very angry about it, accusing our country that we're not going to give them visas to hundreds and hundreds of them. They came and get in line.
Well, that's because they're not from Afghanistan. it's like we bring in Afghani, you know, Sharia Muslim American haters, and we leave Americans behind. Mm-hmm. Tell me that isn't by design. Yeah, I got a question on Haiti though, because Haiti fascinates me because it's on the other side of the Dominican Republic. Dominican Republic you never hear about.
Mm-hmm.
It's a prosperous, you know, Western style republic with, a good economy. People are happy. Tourists go there. You know, things work out pretty well. And then this imaginary line you cross, then you're in Haiti. And Haiti has been a dictatorship. You know, I remember Papa Doc and Baby Doc, the Duvaliers, you know, and this is something that's gone on like Cuba. It just keeps going on and on. And then you get Haitians who've come to Florida. There's a huge Haitian community here, apparently. I remember when Kevin Derby from Florida Daily News used to come on and talk about a large Haitian community. So there's nothing inherent about Haitians that makes them poor and run by dictators. That's not in their human nature. That's not in their character, because Haitians here, you know, in many cases do just fine. The difference is freedom. So how do we get a place?
Yeah.
So why, I'm wondering why the Dominican Republic hasn't tried to influence, you know, the people in Haiti, and the people in Haiti haven't said, we want a republic too. We want to be as prosperous as the Dominican Republic. Why can't we have what they have when we're on the same damn island? It doesn't make sense to me. What's going on?
Because they have corrupt leaders, and our government hasn't helped either. And I don't mean helping, meaning we're going to go there and take over. Meaning we're giving money and money and money to Haiti to help, and it goes into the pocket of the corrupt leaders.
And
this is what's been happening to Cambodia and some of those countries. The kids are like bones walking. So the corruption, the level of corruption in Haiti is so bad. We do have little Haiti in Miami because we have different places in Miami where people take their little own neighborhood. Like we have little Nicaragua, we have little Haiti, little Havana, and so we got different. In Peru, there's an area just for Peruvians.
Do we have little Kabul yet? Do we have little Kabul, Afghanistan yet? It's coming.
No, not in Miami, because we don't want them there. They're being sent to all those up north states. That's what Obama set them up. Because when the people from Africa were coming from the Congo and all those countries, they were requesting to go to Michigan and to go to all those places up north. There's a
Little Somalia or little Mogadishu is in Minnesota. I mean, why would you go from one of the hottest places on earth? Why would you go from one of the hottest places on earth, Somalia, to Minnesota, which is one of the coldest places on earth? That doesn't make sense.
I know.
It's weird. Unless liberalism warms
Obama,
you more than, you know.
The reason Obama set them up in those states is so they can take over those states. And for sure, 100%, we're going to have Muslims representing us in the Senate. So that's the purpose of those three or four states that Obama has chose when he was in power. But Haiti's a mess. Still chaos in the streets. They're shooting people in the street. I was watching a report. The police there, they don't care. They've just been shooting a lot of people. The same thing like in Chicago here. About 57 shot a couple nights ago this weekend. But nobody talks about it because those people are not important, according to
the Democrats. We're going to talk about it because I'm going to jump in here for a second and I say I hope you can stay past this hour because you know you can stay the whole rest of the show if you want. But I had a thought happen to me just before the show, and I was thinking Chicago's they're doing the exact opposite of what should be done, of course, because that's what Democrats do. They've been trying to limit the guns, get rid of the guns, ban the guns, and of course the criminals have all the guns they want. But what I was thinking of is what if we depopulated Chicago? What if we took away men between, I posted this on Facebook, really close before the show, but what if we took men away, 16 to 25, like the gang age, and put them in, depression style work camps, like the CCC, WPA, had them on the forest, had them building things, maybe they go to a boot camp, maybe they could serve in the forces, depopulate the gangs by literally taking young men. And this is probably highly unconstitutional, but I want to talk about it anyway. But the idea is, and then, or have states have a relocation program. In other words, if there's a decent family want to get out of Chicago, come here, Florida. I'm sure we would actually welcome some decent families from Chicago to get out of that hellhole, so that their sons are not going to be killed in a gang war. I bet you. And the best thing to do is depopulate. Say, look, you people, obviously, you Democrat leaders, you obviously can't handle the situation because you've got these folks killing each other. You're not doing anything about it. So either it's in your interest, or you're making money off it, or you just don't care. As long as you get your power, you're happy. So what if we depopulate Chicago, took away their tax base, took away their commercial base, took away their money with the people there, and said, look, we're actually going to give you a better life. And we could have done this with the money we spent on illegal aliens that the Biden insurrection has spent bringing people in. But what if we had a Chicago relocation program? Families could go to other states, and young men would basically, of gang age, just be removed for a few years, and maybe we'll have other options to talk about. But if we get rid of the men and give them something to do during those gang years, if there's no men to be in a gang, there's no gangs, there's no violence. And might that be a draconian solution to go, oh, this is interesting. There's nobody here to shoot each other. it's just a thought. It's kind of a wild idea because it's never been done before. But what if we depopulated the gangs? Go ahead.
Greg, it's funny that you're mentioning this because I just heard a report that in a few of the Democrats' states, they're paying the criminals not to murder people. So they're giving them money. Not
I believe that's called extortion. That's extortion.
I was laughing. I was like,
oh, yeah. Well, if we can do that, let's pay them to fix the roads. let's put them in a work camp.
Yeah.
And so young men who are likely to be in a gang, likely to kill each other, who are graduates of these substandard Chicago government schools, let's teach them some stuff, get them out of there so that they literally cannot be in a gang to kill each other because they're not there for a certain period of their life. Now, is that indentured servitude and is that all the things that people are going to complain about? Yes, it is. But you show me an alternative to break the cycle of violence in Chicago, we're probably going to be saving some lives, probably saving a lot of lives by doing it. And you're physically removing the people. It'd be like removing an army from a war. Say, okay, we're not going to fight anymore. We're gone. There's no war. There's nobody to fight. They've left. It's like if World War One, if one side had just left the trenches, if the other side had run over, well, how far are they going to get? There's only so far they can go before the citizens shoot them all.
Before we put our young men in the military, but now since it's a choice, they're not going to want to go. Like, for example, a few young people that I know personally, they decided not to go to college. They say, oh, they're going to work at McDonald's, they're going to work at Wendy's, they're going to work at Publix, they're going to work at, And before you know it, they're involved with drugs, and they're drugs now, So they didn't go to college, they didn't go to the military because their family didn't force them. Like back in the old days, as soon as you get out of school, you're going in the military, young men. And those are parents that really care and kids that obey. But kids doesn't obey nothing. Kids are running the show now.
Parents aren't requiring. Parents aren't requiring their kids either. They don't have expectations for them. They don't think of them as succeeding.
The kids are running their household. That's what's happening. Like the kids, a lot of kids in my church, the kids are telling the parents, "Nah, I don't want to go to choir." So you know what? The choir of the children's ministry slowly but surely is dying because the kids are in control, not the parents. No.
Well, it's funny you should say that. There were a few things I was forced to do as a kid that I didn't want to, and then they worked out fabulous. One of them was Cub Scouts and Boy Scouts. And especially, I don't want to do that. I don't want to wear this uniform and do all this kind of crazy stuff. Turned out I loved it, I was forced to take piano lessons, which I absolutely hated, but I said, look, I can't play this instrument. I hate it. It sucks. I want to be a trouble player. I want to be Herb Alpert, you know. So in other words, the force of the music, I didn't mind music. I like music. I just couldn't stand the piano because it made no sense to me, you know, because I think in pictures. And so that's why guitar is good and trumpet was, oh, I sucked on trumpet. It wasn't until I hit the tuba that I did stuff. But in other words, certain times being forced to do things, water skiing. You know, I was kind of ashamed of it because everybody else was doing it on this lake and this big lodge we went to. And I can't water. If you see my feet and the angles that they point, you know, I think water skiing is a real challenge. But I was, you know, I did it. And a lot of things that you're forced to do sometimes end up being your greatest accomplishments and favorite things to do. So there's nothing wrong with that as long as you're not forced permanently to do it. But to have kids, you know, take dance lessons or play sports or do things like that. In Australia, they forced me to play sports. I wasn't big on sports, but it turned out I found a few that I loved, you know, rowing on the crew team and tennis. Mm-hmm. Absolutely loved them, you know. So the question then became, which sports can I do? Yeah, go ahead.
Parents are not parents anymore because parents know best for their kids until they grow up and make their own decision. Mm-hmm. You know, like my daughter, she was seeing all her friends with a phone at the age of 11, 12, 13. I said, no, when you turn 16, you'll get your first phone. When you turn 16, you can put black fingernail polish in your hands if you want. But meanwhile, you're not going to wear black fingernail polish. And to this day, my daughter's not allowed, and she's out of my home, and she's 27. She's not allowed to have one tattoo. The first tattoo I see, I take her off the inheritance, and she don't want to lose all that money.
Ooh,
so
that's
the deal that I made.
Yeah,
because that's my rule, and she needs to obey. If not, she's not going to get nothing. She's the only child, so she'll get quite a bit. But you have to help your children, because until they're 30 years old, they still cannot make the right decision sometimes.
Yeah. Well, in my situation, my family was so destructive that I had to make my own decisions to get away from it. So there are families and there are families. How much do you think the divorce rate, the fact that fathers are absent, from so many homes. I posted an article about this, and you know, one person got after me on Facebook, but the fact, this is from a divorce lawyer, that said one of our biggest problems is that courts, although it's not as bad as it used to be, there's still a lot of favoritism, you know, against men in divorce court. You know, fathers are routinely denied access to their own kids, you know, and you've got kids growing up without fathers. In fact, a lot of, you know, women decide to be single mothers and not have a father. They name the wrong father on the birth certificate because that one has more money. You know, you've got guys raising kids that aren't their own kids. You've got guys who, in this TED Talk, this woman, divorce lawyer, was talking about women who, you know, have a kid, never tell the father that they're a father, and raise the kid on their own because they don't want the father. I mean, how selfish can you get? You know, that's kidnapping. And so you've got a problem where we have a society that actually encourages single motherhood in many ways, you know, and fathers are the single biggest predictor of staying out of jail, of career, of avoiding teenage pregnancy, of all kinds of other things. And yet we as a society are denying fathers, you know, to this day for families. It's crazy.
In a way, we don't want our children to leave their home until we turn them into their husband to get married. But the American way is as soon as you're 18, you're out of the house. They want to kick you right out. And the kids are too young to make adult decisions still at 18 years old. And I
see
a lot of my friends' family, the kids are hooked on drugs. And, you know, why? Because you kick them out, 18, bye-bye. And we don't put grandparents in nursing homes either. We all take turns. We never put grandparents in nursing homes because a lot of bad things happen to them. A lot, a lot, a lot.
Oh, that's for sure.
But that's our way, and it works out. It works out very good, actually, for us.
So for little families, are there stats?
If you want for a few minutes.
Yeah, no, there are all kinds of stats, I'm sure, that back that up. But it would be interesting to take a look at the families. And that, I think Asian families are very much the same way, you know, that they have long extended family traditions, you know, and so that's the best way. Because I know friends that are taking care of their parents, you know, individually, you know, either one or both of them.
It's
a huge strain because other members of the family are like, screw that. You know, I'm on my own. I'm doing my own thing. Thank you very much. Leave me alone. You know, and so there's a certain thing. my family is no good example because they purposely made my life, you know, as miserable as they possibly could because they had mental problems and, you know, that's a different issue. So for my kind of family, it was imperative that I get away and raise myself and do my own thing and move to California on my own and, you know, get away from, you know, any connection to any family just because, you know, but that's unusual. That's not the norm. I mean, the ideal situation that would have been nice to have would have been a nice family that was supportive and, you know, with full guidance and all those kind of things. All right. I've got another report. I've got our Articles of Confederation for my Santa Rosa Volunteer Report. And then we're going to get into the question of the day. You know, the title of the show today, Jets Hit the Top of the World Trade Center, but they collapsed from the bottom. How did that happen? Mm-hmm. So, Josie, you can bring it. I'm going to let you open that hour. And then I want to present this article that I talked about. So take a break, everybody. We're going to spend 8 minutes dealing with the Articles of Confederation, which I literally recorded about a minute before the show started. It was a production, so I'm not exactly sure how it turned out. So we'll give this a shot here, and we'll be back. You can mute yourselves, or I'll probably mute you anyway, and listen to this and see what you think. This is Craig Penglis for Action Radio with Founding Moments, insights into our founding documents, sponsored by Santa Rosa Volunteers here in Santa Rosa County, Florida. Santa Rosa Volunteers is available at their website, srv1776.com. That's srv1776.com. It has occurred to me in discussing the Anti-Federalist Papers in relation to the Articles of Confederation that the Anti-Federalist Papers seem to be lacking in context, having not gone over the Articles of Confederation in this series on our founding documents. During the time period we are analyzing, the Constitution had been written and was in the process of being sold to the individual states in order to be ratified. So at the time of this debate, the country was still under the Articles of Confederation. People could clearly see how the Articles worked and what the Anti-Federalist Papers were getting at. Whereas with the Federalist Papers, there was no experience with the Constitution. So it was like they were advertising with the Federalist Papers to sell their product with no knowledge of how or if that product worked. My impressions formed over time of the Articles is that they didn't work, weren't strong enough, caused trade wars, and were generally inefficient for government to operate. Now, rather than read scholarly works to try to and convince me of their point of view, I shall go over the Articles myself using reason, logic, and my knowledge of history, so that you can then draw your own observations and conclusions as to the overall question of that time, should the United States adopt the new Constitution or fix the problems of the Articles of Confederation. History is written by winners, and I assume the perceptions and opinions of the winners are handed down through time as well. Since the Constitution was ratified and the Federalists were the winners, it makes sense that even today, the perceptions and opinions of the Articles of Confederation would be as the Federalists saw it. And so they would have perpetuated through time their opinion that the Constitution was superior, even if their motives in part were as shallow as to want the Constitution simply because it would give them more power and a bigger federal government than was possible under the Articles of Confederation. And that question I will leave to you to ponder. From the Articles of Confederation preamble, whereas the delegates of the United States of America in Congress assembled did on the 15th day of November in the year of our Lord, 1777, and in the second year of the independence of America, agree to certain Articles of Confederation and perpetual union between the states of New Hampshire, Massachusetts Bay, Rhode Island, and Provincetown Plantations, Connecticut, New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Delaware, Maryland, Virginia, North Carolina, South Carolina, and Georgia. Article 1. The style of this Confederacy shall be the United States of America. Article 2. Each state retains its sovereignty, freedom, and independence, and every power, jurisdiction, and right, which is not by this Confederation expressly delegated to the United States in Congress assembled. Article 2 appears very much like the 10th Amendment, where powers not specifically delegated to the federal government in the Constitution are reserved to the states. Now, why would this be left out of the original Constitution when it already existed in the Articles of Confederation? It later had to be put back in when the Bill of Rights was adopted some 4 years after the ratification of the Constitution. Could it be said, as I believe, that the Federalists actually left out state protections and limitations of federal power guaranteed by the Articles of Confederation in order to form a more powerful and larger federal government without those limitations and protections? This is just the first example. Article 3. The said states hereby severally enter into a firm league of friendship with each other for their common defense, the security of their liberties, and their mutual and general welfare, binding themselves to assist each other against all force offered to or attacks made upon them or any of them on account of religion, sovereignty, trade, or any other pretense whatsoever. Article 3 contains some of the future First Amendment to the Bill of Rights with regard to religion. Article 3 also contains a strong clause of mutual protection by the states themselves for the states themselves. The Constitution has the Congress and President as the sole protector of the states. The Constitution, as ratified, removed any mutual cooperative pact such as this between the states, so that under the Constitution, it is the federal government only which holds the country together and binds the states to the United States, and the states themselves have become isolated islands, operating individually and separately under the Union, with no mutual support or protection. This removal of the firm League of Friendship appears to have been necessary for the Federalists so that the federal government under the Constitution shall not have to compete with the mutual friendship pledged by the states to each other in the Articles of Confederation. Thus, the federal government would have no rival government domestic power, nor check and balance on itself, and as such, could eventually conquer the states, having thus divided them under the Constitution into individual units separate from each other. One wonders if the Confederate states formed their Confederacy in part to create the same firm League of Friendship against the Union that resulted in the Civil War, but might never have happened had all the states of the Union had a mutual pledge of friendship and security binding them to assist each other against the ever-increasing power of the federal government in Washington, D.C. Was Lincoln as much a Federalist as those who ratified the Constitution, and just as adamant against the states binding together in any form, as a rival to the federal government's power, irrespective of the question of slavery? This raises the question of whether the states should once again enter into a firm league of friendship today for their security against the overwhelming and still increasing power of the federal government. Would such a States United pact be equal or greater to the United States federal government, where all the states were bound together to assist each other against all force offered to or attacks made upon them per Article 3 of the Articles of Confederation by the national government? Think about that this week before we continue with the next part of the Articles of Confederation. The source for the Federalist Papers is federalistpapers.org. The Anti-Federalist Papers are from selfeducatedamerican.com. The Articles of Confederation are from usconstitution.net. This is Greg Penglis for Action Radio with Founding Moments, sponsored by Santa Rosa Volunteers. Their website is srv1776.com. That's srv1776.com. Please share this report to anyone who needs it. All right. Well, that should give you all something to think about. Gene, Josie, I mean, I'm full of what-ifs.
We're back.
When I, Yeah, you guys are back, but I'm full of what ifs because, you know, what if the Civil War resulted from the fact that the Articles of Confederation denied the states the ability to form their own pacts, their own compact against the federal government, and as such could not be a check on its power, and that the Confederacy was a second attempt to form a pact of the states, you know, like I say, irrespective of slavery, which, you know, I consider a separate issue, but the idea of the states were divided, and once divided could be easily conquered and run by the federal government. I just found that it was an interesting revelation reading over the articles, and this is why this series is as much for my benefit as anybody else's. Any comments on that? And then we'll go after the building issue.
No, I'm good.
Jean? Josie?
No, I don't have. I have no comments.
Okay, all right. So as everybody remembers where they were on 9/11, all right, I was in a white 1965 Ford Falcon. I bought an old car because I wanted something that worked, and the newer cars were a bunch of junk. And I'm going to work, and all of a sudden I hear about this. This is in California. All right. Everybody knows where they were. And so we heard about the buildings, you know, and then, of course, we later saw, if you didn't see them immediately, you saw this horrific event, I mean, absolutely disgusting event, where airplanes were hijacked and flown directly into the World Trade Center. There was one that was supposed to hit the White House that crashed in a field in Pennsylvania when the passengers, you know, fought back. Unfortunately, they couldn't seize the airplane in time. And then, of course, there was one at the Pentagon, and I don't know how many others, you know, were involved. But, of course, the big ones are the two that hit the World Trade Center. And the question has always arisen, you know, how is it – and people were asking this, but, you know, of course, the official government, you know, story came out, just like Flight 800, just like, you know, all the other things, Lusitania, you know, you name it, all the way through history. The government always has an explanation for things that they either want to happen or are willing to make use of. As Rahm Emanuel said, don't let a crisis go to waste. And so these airplanes crashed into the top, and the buildings collapsed on the bottom. And that never made any sense to me. You know, again, we look at it through logic and reason. We're not trying to be emotional. You know, we're not trying to, you know, be against the government. The New World Order is taking over, even though I do happen to think that's a big part of it, if not the whole reason. But what kind of government officials, when you think about that, could actually plant either the demolition charges or the different or something strong enough to melt the bottom of the buildings to have them drop vertically in both instances, you know, with airplanes to hit the top? That to me is irrational to think that those events are exactly connected, where no other source but the airplanes hitting the top caused the buildings to crash, you know, from the bottom. That just doesn't make sense. Gene, you want to try this one? Then I'm going to let Josie go. Gene? I think we talked about this a little bit earlier, but I want to do it again.
Yeah. No, I could see it happening if you just look at what's going on now with the coronavirus and what's going on now with Afghanistan and not being told the truth. So that's anybody with an agenda can do anything. And if you talk to the right people in government, how easily it can be covered up.
Yeah. Josie, I know you have a take on this.
Yes, I do.
Go for it.
To me, it was well organized. This is my opinion. Well organized by the Democrats with George Bush in some of the Muslim countries.
Okay.
This was well organized, completely, the whole thing. Just like Oklahoma bombing, that was well organized.
Oh, I got an article on that too.
all the shootings in Sandy Hook, the space shuttle explosion Challenger. It's all well organized, this whole thing.
Yeah, see, I'm somewhere a little different. I mean, like I say, I like to look at the events. I do believe Flight 800 was brought down by a missile because I know enough about, you know, aviation fuel systems that, you know, if one 747 is going to explode, that similar 747s in the same situation are going to explode. If one airplane has micro cracks in the wings, you know, chances are other airliners of the same type in the same amount of flying hours are going to have those same cracks, and that's usually what happens. That's what happened with the de Havilland Comet, the first jet airliner. They lost about four of them in fairly rapid succession, and all for the same reason: micro cracks, you know, in the wing structure, because it was the first jet airliner and there was new technology. They didn't know what to do. All right, so let's talk about the World Trade Center. First of all, a little anecdotal story. I stood on the top of one of the World Trade Center buildings. I can't remember which one. I think the one without the radar tower on top. I was there for a band exchange. We from Lexington High School, we went to visit a band in New York, and our band director arranged for us to go to the top of, I think it was college. No, it was college. That's right. So our marching band, University of Massachusetts marching band, and we ended up on top of the World Trade Center. Okay. Beautiful sunny day. It was gorgeous. You know, I remember very clearly seeing the autograph of Philippe Petit. If you remember, Philippe Petit was the French tightrope walker that actually walked between the two towers. His autograph was there. Mm-hmm. And so standing on the top of one of the most incredible views anywhere I've ever seen, anywhere on top of the World Trade Center. So I was there. So this is personal for me, having been there, you know. And so it was an incredible thing to watch these buildings come down, thinking, you know, what if it had happened when I was up there with my band? You know, it's like all those, you know, what if I was there stories. Just like the earthquake in San Francisco. You know, the freeway that collapsed was one that I took routinely, except that one particular day when I was in flight school and they said, your plane's down for maintenance, don't come in. Otherwise, I would have been under the Cypress structure that collapsed in San Francisco. So God obviously had plans for me beyond, obviously there were plans for me beyond, you know, what I was doing. And this is, I think Action Radio is where I was intended to go. So I'm going to, you know, keep this going as much as possible. All right. So I found an article. Again, I like to deal with, especially science and engineering when it comes to these buildings, and actually take a look at the building structure. Now, I'm not going to go through all the formulas. You can do that yourself. The website is Soapboxy, S-O-A-P-B-O-X-I-E. This is written August 17th, 2021. So this is recent. Okay, this is in preparation for the 20th anniversary. The author, Mario Buildreps, I don't even know if that's his real name, B-U-I-L-D-R-E-P-S. That sounds a little bit crazy. Graduate engineer, became aware of topics in a way you have never heard before. Okay, so again, I'm going to spare you the fuss, but I want to go through this article. It's on my Facebook page. It is on the Action Radio group. That's the public page. Anybody can take a look at it, or just go to the website I just gave you. Okay, all our shows are podcasts, so you know the citations of all articles I use on the show are always put in so that you can check the information yourself. So the first question, why did it collapse? And right from the article, it seems hard to prove that the collapse of the Twin Towers was an inside job. From the few known facts, it appears that the alleged buckling scenario has no mathematical basis, which implies that full collapse was impossible without introducing an unknown force in the core of the building. Let me try that again. From the few known facts, it appears that the alleged buckling scenario, in other words, the bending of the structure at the bottom to allow the whole the top to come down, has no mathematical basis. I mean, that's huge right there. Which implies that full collapse was impossible without introducing an unknown force in the core of the building. He says seismic recordings from the closest by the seismic recording station at Palisades are often claimed as proof that explosives would be detonated just before the collapse. But this source cannot deliver any proof because seismic activity prior to the major collapse does not prove the ignition of explosives. Which leads to the whole idea that this probably wasn't demolition charges, okay? It is indirect, and therefore there is no direct proof that there were explosions before this thing came down. So, I mean, they're dealing with this pretty honestly, all right? They're not going for the easy solution, all right? It says the official version tells that the towers collapsed by the heat of the fire after the impact in combination with a damaged main structure. But how likely is it that this fire could cause a perfect vertical collapse, a perfect full vertical collapse? I would say no. I would say there's no chance that it could have done that.
No.
Not only could they not have done it, it couldn't have done it twice exactly as it was done. That to me is impossible odds. All right. And yet they're not conspiracy theory. They're not saying, you know, it's not the new world order. It's not a big plot. They're looking at this very scientific. And this is why I like this article. It took me a long time to find it. Weeks, in fact. Anyway. It says the collapse mechanism of the Twin Towers might look complicated to a layman, but it is not as difficult as it seems. Mathematics is the ultimate key to reveal the hidden truth. Okay, and again, I'm going to avoid all the formulae so that you don't get lost, you know, as we go through this. This is one. This article shows how much energy was released before and during the collapse. Two, this article shows which forces were active just before and during the collapse. And three, the calculations are accurate enough to draw conclusions from that lead to an inevitable end conclusion. This is, if you have no scientific background, this article will be too difficult to understand. Yeah, we're just going to kind of go through it. So before I get into this, facts and figures here, Josie, what do you know about World Trade Center 7, the building that collapsed but nothing hit it? Have you heard about that?
No, but the funny thing is that after almost 20 years, on September 11th, they still have the criminals behind, they're saying, in Gitmo, and they haven't even done any trials at all. So that's odd.
Trials for what? For Gitmore for doing what? Are we talking about the terrorists?
For the world, yeah. For the terrorists, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, who was it? The Blind Sheikh? Well, the World Trade Center has been bombed a couple of times. It was bombed earlier by the Blind Sheikh, if I remember. And I think it was kind of like a trial run. But Bianca's on the line. We haven't heard from him for way too long. You know. Hey, dude,
where
you been?
Where have you been, Bianca?
What's going on? We miss you.
Well, I was Monday morning, I was laying in the bed, and I kept hearing somebody saying, ahoy, ahoy. I looked out the window. My house had floated out in the ocean off the
Cuban
shore.
Oh, no.
I recognize the flag.
Oh, I'm so sorry. You had a flood. Wow. Do you want to
the house was out in the ocean. I had floated off the shores of Cuba.
So where are you now calling from?
From Cuba.
I'm back on shore.
Okay, good.
I'm back on shore. Everything's normal now. So
okay.
I didn't meet the great Neptune. The well, so I'm okay. Everything's cool.
Do you have a ground floor, or is it all washed away?
No. You hear what I said. I said the house was floating out in the Atlantic Ocean off the shores of Cuba, and I kept hearing people say, ahoy, ahoy, ahoy.
Oh, okay. I thought your house had flooded with the Ida thing moving through. My mistake. Okay,
no,
well, welcome back.
Okay.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
Well, we're glad you're safe.
The towers, 415 meters. Outside perimeter, 63 by 63 meters. Inside support core, 24 by 42 meters. Stories, 110. Floor height, 3.77 meters. Basement, 5 stories, 21 meters. This thing goes down, 5 stories, right? Estimated empty weight, 475,000 metric tons. Even this is how detailed this report gets. Actually measured the weight of the World Trade Center towers. Estimated operational weight, 565,000 metric tons. That's all you overweight office workers, okay? Specific average empty weight, 108 kilojoules per meter squared. Okay. This is where we're going to lose you, okay? We start getting into these numbers. But anyway, maximum wind load, okay? 140 miles an hour. Construction type, steel egg crate. Earthquake proof, up to a 5 magnitude earthquake, and that's a P wave. Natural swing frequency, 11 seconds. So you get that? This thing swings back and forth in a storm over the course of 11 seconds. That's how flexible this building is. All right. Dampening construction, viscoelastic dampers, 100 per floor. So multiply by 110 floors. There's a lot of dampeners, from movement. Bomb attack, February 26, 1993, in the basement. We talked about that. Airplane attack, September 11, 2001, centered on the 81st and the 95th floors, respectively, of the towers. And then you got a little diagram here, twin towers compared with other structures. They weren't the tallest. I think the tallest one is this thing in Dubai that's just huge. Okay, facts and figures. I'm going to skip that. Specific weight. All right. Questions so far. You guys all with me? Bianca, you're in construction. What do you think? What's your opinion on the World Trade Center? If an airplane flies to the top, will it crunch from the bottom?
Well, I spent 40 years putting up buildings like that. I had a company that put up structure steel buildings.
That's what I'm glad
you
called.
Before,
yeah, I remember. I would. So?
I would have slept on the ground floor lobby while planes ran into the top of the building all day long.
I don't understand that. So,
I would not have been afraid to sleep in the lobby while planes flew into the top floors all day long.
Okay.
And you have the same problem with engineers speaking their mind as you do doctors with COVID.
Yep. That's why there's a great parallel here. Yeah.
It's scared of being having their license stripped away from them or ostracized.
Huh. Okay.
Meaning, Bianchi's saying that building was impossible to come down the way it did. That's what he meant. That he would have been in the basement sleeping, and the only harm would have been the top part where the planes hit. But that's not exactly what happened. They well organized it to bring it all down just in a perfect from top to bottom, all the way down, like when they destroy buildings and they don't want to harm other buildings. I got you.
The structure steel is fire coated. Mm-hmm. And around the core elevator shaft, you have fireproof and drywall. Drywall that's probably 4 inches thick, now maybe more,
right.
That has a, you know, has a fire rating to it. So the story about the fuel going down into the building, I don't buy that.
Okay. We got another caller, first-time caller, so I'm going to pop up the line. This is always interesting because we don't really know what's going to happen. So first name and where you're calling from, and what would you like to add to our conversation? Welcome to Action Radio.
Hi, Greg. My name is Tom, and
hi, Tom.
I actually operate a blog talk radio site here with the Writer's Lounge, but finding your conversation very interesting, and, of course, we all have since we lived through that tragedy 20 years ago, but I'm not one to normally jump to conclusions with a conspiracy theory, but I keep my mind
neither
open
are we
to all possibilities, it's very easy to do that. You know, you go back to the Warren Commission with the assassination of President Kennedy, and it's really easy to jump on the wagon there, but I kind of keep an open mind and try to look at everything. But what I was
what state are you calling from, first of all? I want to get your location here, Tom. Where are you calling from?
Syracuse,
okay.
New York.
Okay, good.
And so in regards to the buildings, both one and two towers and the other building that fell there, what was the name of it? The smaller building there.
World Trade Center 7. Yep.
And then, but my real questions arise with the Pentagon. How does an airliner fly into the Pentagon and then have no remnants of it left, such as a large engine or, maybe a tail wing or something like that? That part just blows me away. And I was just wondering what your thoughts were on that, and I'll leave it at that.
Well, I haven't specifically – first of all, welcome to the show. Thank you. First of all, I haven't specifically analyzed the Pentagon, and I'll probably do that at some point, maybe next week. But who wants to add? Josie, Pianchi, Gene? Who wants to – what are your thoughts?
I would like to say something.
Josie first.
I would like to say something about the Pentagon. One of our top secret CIA friends brought us in the Pentagon and to give us a tour.
Mm-hmm.
And we were even lunch. They said they didn't find – what the media was saying. It was a missile that hit the Pentagon, not a plane, because when you see the videos, the flame is going very low, and a plane cannot be going that low to hit that area and the Pentagon where it hit. So, no, it was not a plane that hit the Pentagon.
Like a cruise missile, you're thinking, or what?
A missile, just a missile, very low, hit the Pentagon.
Yeah.
Yep.
And can I just jump in real quick?
Sure.
Okay.
Stick around for a while.
The other side of it would be, if it's a missile, then what happened to the people in that airline? They just disappeared? Did they move them somewhere else?
Was it an actual flight? Was there a flight?
My mind.
was it a flight that was logged, that was put on the books but never actually happened? That's possible too. I mean, that's crazy. I want to stick with the World Trade Center. This is a great topic. We'll do this again. We'll do a show on the Pentagon. And Tom, of course, you're welcome to join us, and you're welcome to stick around for the rest of the show. Only about half an hour left. There's a lot I want to get to just on the World Trade Center. This article says most modern skyscrapers are resistant to S-waved earthquakes, which makes buildings swing in heavy storms. We talked about that. 11 seconds back and forth. Towers like the Taipei and Petronas are highly earthquake-proof, up to 8.3 and 7.6 respectively. The twin towers were designed to deal with mild earthquakes of magnitude 5.0, which is still a lot. I mean, I was in the 6.9 earthquake in San Francisco. 5.0 is still a pretty decent jolt, but I don't think New York is on any particular earthquake fault where that would necessarily be a problem. But the point is, these buildings are built for earthquakes. So, if it can sway, it's going to absorb a certain amount of the shock of an airplane hitting it by simply swaying as it would in a high wind or a storm. And yet that's never been talked about. Pianchi, what do you think? Has anybody talked about that?
Well, in the exterior walls of the building and also in the interior, they have braces that provide what they call a push-pull.
Okay.
So when it sway one way, it's pulling, but on the opposite, it's pushing. So the energy that's produced by the wind at the upper floors is absorbed as that energy goes down through the building to the point where it's diminished to nothing.
Interesting. Yeah, because the bases are stronger than the towers. Yeah. You know, it's interesting, too, that when I studied the Japanese buildings, because the San Francisco building had the same thing, they put this enormous water tank on top of some of these skyscrapers, because in an earthquake, when the wave pushes the building one way, the water pushes it the other way, and it's a dampening effect. So it actually sends an inverse wave through the building. And you know what happens is, you know, water sloshes, the boat sloshes, you know, it's like a swimming pool on an ocean liner. The boat sways one way, the water goes the other way. You know, and the same thing here. If the building swings, you know, east, then the water swishes left and west and kind of pushes it back in. So all these things are built into these buildings. My point is that these buildings are a lot more flexible and have a lot of protections way beyond just the actual structure. And the idea that an airplane, as destructive as it is, you know, let's talk airplanes for a minute. Your basic airliner is as light as possible. It's made of aluminum. The only real steel in it is, you know, in the engine compartments and the wing spars and things like that. But the skin of the wings and the fuselage and as much as possible is aviation-grade aluminum. That's not the heaviest metal out there, certainly not the strongest. So how far would an aluminum airplane, you know, crashing into a building, even though it was going 300 to 600 miles an hour, I'm not sure what the speed was, how far would that actually go, given the fact that the aluminum airplane is a whole lot lighter and a whole lot softer and less, you know, strong than the building it's crashing into?
Yeah, the airplane would disintegrate.
Okay. Do you remember the B-25 that crashed into the Empire State Building back in the 40s?
I wasn't living then.
I wasn't either. I wasn't living during Beethoven's time, but I listened to his music, so that's no excuse. Sorry. Tom, do you remember that story?
Yeah, I remember that story, but...
Yeah. Do you know what happened to the airplane and the building? Basically, nothing happened to the building. The airplane was destroyed.
The airplane disintegrated.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. No, 767 is bigger than a B-25. I know. I've been in both. It's actually in the tail gun position of B-25.
The skull of your head is stronger than some components on the airplane.
Yeah, airplanes are soft because they have to be light because they have to fly. And they're great in flying through the air, and they can handle turbulence and bounces, and they're all set for lightning and all kinds of strikes like that, but they really don't do well when they run into things. Not at all. They're not designed for that. They're designed to fly, not hit things. All right. Tom, like I say, jump in anytime here. This is kind of a group effort here, so don't be shy about joining the conversation. Did you have any thoughts so far?
Yeah, I do. I used to be a firefighter, and I find it interesting also that as far as I can tell from the research that I did, I believe back after that happened, was that no fire had contributed to a collapse of a building that size. Usually you get the building is gutted, but they claim, and I have a problem with it, but they claim that the fuel from the airliner caused the structure to actually collapse. I find that very hard to get my head around.
Wouldn't the fuel have burned up in the explosion that we saw? Wouldn't the fuel have caused that explosion? Wouldn't most of it have vaporized in the explosion? I mean, how much would actually make it to the bottom of the building? Not a whole lot, I wouldn't think. Right? Let me get Tom. Then
here's
I guess
another point.
Oh, hold on, Pianki. Yeah. Tom, what do you think?
Yeah, very, very good point. Fuel, to my knowledge, burns quickly. And if it burns quickly, how is it going to bring down a building like that?
Yeah, it's got to generate a whole lot of heat. And the other thing is about the aviation fuel is basically kerosene. It's the cheapest, the least flammable, one of the most stable forms of petroleum there is. It works in a jet because of the ridiculously high compression and speed and velocity and the other things going on with how a jet works. But the fuel itself, cheap-ass dirt kerosene. Pianki, your turn. Then we'll get to Gene and Josie. Pianki?
Well, even so, when the iron workers are putting the buildings up and when they're welding the columns, when they're welding the columns together, they have to preheat the columns. They apply a flame on one side, and they use a temperature stick. It's like a piece of crayon, and they mark it on the inside. And when it changes color, the temperature on the outside is, you know, sufficient in order to make the weld.
Okay.
So that temperature may get up to, you know, close to 500-700 degrees. And that's way more than you're going to achieve with fuel running down through the building the way it has been described.
Well, what does fuel burn at? Does anybody know? I mean, I can look it up. Gene?
Well, it will melt.
Oh,
it would melt. It's not going to just burned.
If I remember the bottom of the article, they talked about 1,500 degrees is necessary to melt steel and metal and things like that. Gina, are you near your computer? Can you tell us
I can look it up on my phone. What do you want?
Find out what temperature jet fuel burns. Yeah, let's do that. All right, let me go back to the article for a second. Unless, Josie, did you have a comment? I'm sorry, I forgot to ask you before I moved on.
No.
Josie?
Go ahead.
Okay.
Go ahead.
So the next part of this, were the Twin Towers earthquake-proof? It says this is an important question because it implies the dynamic strength of the tall the dynamic strength of the tall skyscrapers. The towers were designed to resist a combined S/P waved earthquake up to magnitude of 5. Buildings tend to be the most vulnerable to an S wave type earthquake, especially when they're close to their natural frequency. Again, the Twin Towers natural frequency, I guess the bend from one side to the other was 11 seconds, which is a long time for a building to sway, especially if you're the top. That'd be an interesting thing to feel. Anyway, it says there are approximately 10,000, this is what I don't understand, 10,000 viscoelastic dampers installed in each tower to reduce wind-induced vibrations and S-wave vibrations from earthquakes. Probably the same kind of vibration you'd get that would shatter a building, you know, in a collision when an airplane hit it. I bet you this is the same. It's not that different. I'm going to ask Bianchi and Tom about this. You know, this is the earthquake of magnitude 4 on October 19th, 1985, went by unnoticed. The towers had, as expected, no problem handling this, as most other buildings, by the way. The viscoelastic dampers, as shown in the flanking picture, when you have to see the article, absorb most energy released by an earthquake on a tower, which were evenly distributed from the 10th up to the 110th floor. What these dampers do is partly canceling out destructive energy that might harm the construction. Pianki, do you know anything about viscoelastic dampers? That was new to me.
I never installed those dampers. And
do you know how they work?
I would have to say that they would have to be between the steel and the core of the building.
Okay.
Because vertically, they wouldn't be installed vertically. So they would have to be, you know, the floors tied into the core of the building, which was concrete. So they would probably tie it in there.
Okay. We have about 20 minutes left. I got as much as we can, but just to let people know, I will get to the conclusion before we end the show today. Josie.
Okay, hold on just a second.
I don't know how to construct buildings, but you can ask me all about teeth. I know everything about that dentistry.
Okay, thanks very much. We'll keep that in mind. Gene, you get the temperature jet fuel burns? Isn't this fascinating?
Okay,
we have the greatest resources here. Go ahead.
Jet fuel burns between 800 and 1,500 degrees Fahrenheit.
Okay, so it is hot enough to melt it, but the question is, was there enough of it?
And the members, the steel members are covered with a fireproofing, which has a rating for, about an hour, 2 hours or something like that. In a fire, when you look at a steel structure, the steel would sag. It doesn't just melt, it sags.
Okay.
It still holds together, but it just sags.
Okay, would it make sense that a building that had a fire hard enough to melt the steel, would that melt perfectly uniformly to allow the building to allow 210-story buildings to fall perfectly vertically? Or would it make more sense, as I believe, that a sag would have occurred in a particular direction and the buildings would have fallen sideways, which makes more sense during for my Jeff Goldblum chaos theory from Jurassic Park, that you can't take into account all the variables. Those buildings would have fallen any direction except vertically if they'd melted from the bottom.
Well,
Yucky?
You know, someplace else in the world, I believe it was in Argentina, but I'm not sure.
Uh-huh.
There was a fire of a structural steel building. It burned for a long time. When it cooled off, it stood there like a skeleton.
Interesting. Tom, you got some firefighting experience. Have you ever seen a building destroyed, I think you mentioned this before, from the core because the steel melted? And if it did it bend? Did it warp? Did it fall a particular direction? What happened? What's your experience here?
Well, fortunately for me, I was in a small town volunteer fire department, so we didn't deal with high structures, you know, one or two-story wood frame homes is usually what we dealt with. So I don't have any experience going into a high rise like that, but it, you know, the conversation is very interesting. The only thing I would like to add is that everywhere that I've looked and watched a building go down like those two buildings would indicate to me that it was a detonator that set them off to bring them down. It's the only thing it looked like to me. you know.
But again, yet the article says that the seismic evaluation, when they actually measured the tremors, said that Earth, that there could not have been explosives that did this. This is why I find this article so intriguing, because it's actually saying that the most obvious solution would be demolition charges. But they're saying the demolition charges couldn't have done it because the seismic waves don't report that that was a possibility based on the seismic measuring before the buildings came down. I find that fascinating. I think you missed that part. You called in a bit later, but yeah.
Yeah, I did.
Okay. All right.
Yeah,
check the podcast.
It's really,
it'll give you the article,
it's
too.
It's very, very intriguing.
Okay. Here's another part. It says, go ahead.
Greg, on
that, the article.
On that size, the demolition charges started at the top. And the forces would have been absorbed through the bracing of the building ahead of it. If that's why he didn't probably wouldn't receive boom 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 boom. So each boom on its way down to the ground would have been absorbed through the bracing of the structure. It wouldn't reach the ground.
So you're saying. All right, let me get this straight so everybody understands. You're saying that the demolition charges were throughout the entire building, that they were sequenced to go off from the top all the way to the bottom?
They were sequenced to go off from the top to the bottom. It's not the entire building at one time. How would you control it? You would have fell over on the pizza building across the street.
Exactly. Are buildings ever are demolished that way, or it usually looks like they collapse. They set the charges off at the base, and the building collapses on top of them. Do they actually, is that a known science or practice that charges are set at the top of the building and that allows the building to come down?
You want it to fall within its own footprint. So the interior, the center of the building falls down, then it helps pull the outside down on top of it.
Okay. And is that done with charges at the bottom and the top generally?
Not at the top.
Not at the top.
Because you need to wait to help it to fall. Now, I'm not a demolition expert, but if I was to look at a building, and plus, too, you know, down in the lower floor, you had column shaft that was cut on a bevel. So the top of the shaft would slide past the bottom.
Let me get to that. We've got we don't have enough time to do as much as I want in this article. It also says that due to the earthquake resistance and the construction could carry in static circumstances approximately 420% of the weight of the towers at ground zero level. So they were strong enough to carry 400% of its own weight. That's a huge safety factor. It says the Twin Towers' specific design, the outer cage, which gave the towers a specific look, acted as a major resistor against swinging. So it had resistance to that, too. It made the towers extremely stiff. And I've seen those steel things that go back and forth, I guess the egg crate thing. This high stiffness had consequences for the structure in the core, which had to take higher loads. The core structure had to be approximately 21% stronger. This resulted in a building that was able to withstand 508% of its own empty weight in static situations. These things are pretty damn strong. These things were amazing.
Well, not only that.
Okay, go ahead.
The core was rigid. The core had to be rigid, made out of, you would have had encased concrete, because you have elevator shafts, elevator cars that rise up the core, and their towers is a lot greater than it is on the outside. So you can't have, in other words, when you build a core, it has to be pretty much straight, as I can say that, because you have these cars that travel from the bottom up to the top, the elevator cars. And if it wasn't straight, and if it was allowed to sway back and forth, a car could just get stuck, lodged in someplace between the bottom and the top.
Yeah, interesting. Here's another part, too. It's the storm resistance of the Twin Towers. This is an important factor in the case of 9/11 because it was a day with not much wind, which means that the full overcapacity in strength was available. The towers were designed to handle wind speeds of 225 kilometers. That's 140 miles an hour. That's a part of like a Class 3 hurricane. This is a dynamic load similar as with the horizontal motions, the S waves, during earthquakes. The maximum handleable wind load results in a force at the base that equals approximately 18% of its own weight. Well, it can handle like 400% of its own weight. So that's we got this huge safety factor. This load is dynamic as well, which means it has to be factored with 2.65. I guess that's an engineering number. The result is an extra strength, an extra required strength of 48%. Since earthquakes and wind load were possible to occur at the same moment, this was taken into account. So they got static strength, 978%, you know, stronger than its weight in a static situation, or 9.78 times stronger than its weight. So it was almost 10 times as strong as it had to be. Wow. And I got a bunch of figures here. I'm going to skip down. Anybody have a comment? And then I'm going to get to another section of this. Yeah.
Yeah. Earthquake would cause a building to bounce up and down. The wind causes it to go sideways.
Mm-hmm. Well, see, now, an earthquake is a wave, all right? Believe me, I've been in them. You rise up and
well,
down.
Yeah, it is a wave.
It's a wave, right?
It is a wave, just like a ripple wave, but that's it's vertical movement up and down. That's what a damper. You know, in Japan, some of those buildings are sitting on big springs in the basement.
Oh, yeah, Teflon base, you know, the Transamerica Pyramid, same thing. Yeah, they got a Teflon base. The building, actually, the building stays still and the earth moves back and forth. It's the most amazing thing to see the construction over the Transamerica.
Well, you actually see big, huge springs, like automobile car springs.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. You know, so in other words, these buildings are built
for
impact.
Earthquake. Yeah, that's for earthquakes. The wind is a different thing. The wind, the forces from the wind would be absorbed in the vertical bracing.
Yeah.
And then when the floor beams attached to the core, that would be sitting on Teflon where it allowed to slide. That's your buffer.
See, I don't know if the World Trade Center had that same thing because, again, it's not an earthquake-specific zone, so I don't know if they had as much on
that.
Well,
it had to. I'm sure it did, but
probably did. Yeah.
I wasn't in the building. I see other buildings built. You got one in St. Louis, the Eagleton Courthouse, is 40 stories, not 110 stories, but it has that same possible.
Many old buildings are required to have that now just for liability. Anyway, let me get to another section here. It says, how impact-proof were the Twin Towers? This is what we're talking about with airplanes crashing in. Empirical determination is the best way to find out the impact resistance of a building. It says, on February 26, 1993, a bomb exploded in the basement. This is 550, kilogram TNT equivalent, which is equivalent to 2.3 gigajoules. All right. The explosion damaged four floors together, 16,000 meters squared. I mean, it's more engineering numbers. It says there was damage on floors just above and below the explosions, but there was no damage to the main structure that carried the full weight of the tower. I think that's significant. You can damage floors without damaging the main structure, which is exactly what I think happened with the airplanes. It says, back to the article, based upon this event, it is possible to determine the resistance of the building against explosions or impacts, which was at least, and then we got another number here, 0.144 mJ/m2. I guess that's megajoules by meter squared. Anyway, well, I'll let you guys, engineers, read those numbers. Anyway, the average horizontal blast time to nearby walls at basement level. It indicates that the main structure could withstand of some outrageous number, which is very high, 34.5 gigajoules per meter squared per hour. Don't ask me to explain the formulas. That's where they lose me. But here's where it gets interesting. The basement was stronger than the rest of the tower. For the main support structure of high-rise buildings, count the rule, the higher, the weaker, which makes sense. More flexible, able to sway at the top, stronger, more rigid at the bottom. Here's where it gets really interesting. The towers were constructed to handle an impact of a Boeing 707-320B flying at a speed of 607 miles an hour, weighing 152,400 kilograms, that's 336,000 pounds. The energetic equivalent of this, and they got another formula, all right? The Boeing 67 that hit Tower 1 weighed about 180 metric tons and flew around 503 miles an hour. Which equals the kinetic energy that this plane released onto a small part of the construction tower was another formula here. This thing was already built to handle a 707. You know, that's smaller than a 767, but it was also built to handle it going 100 miles an hour faster. You know, mass times velocity. What's acceleration? Mass times velocity? You know, so something going, you know, it's like bullets. People know that 45 caliber bullets, fly slower, but they have more impact because they're heavier. You know, so they impact further. You know, it's fascinating. This thing was actually designed to handle the impact of a Boeing 707. That's a big airplane. Bianchi.
Yeah, and too, what you call an explosion was actually thermite. Thermite is when they weld two rails, like railroad rails together, they use a chemical called thermite that heats up a concentrating area where the metal melts, then it cools off and it binds itself together. So they use thermite. They put the thermite in. They put it in on a slant. When it was set off, it burned. and the slant allowed it to slip right past one, slip right past the other.
Yeah. That's
pretty
interesting.
I keep talking like this. I have a man with black teeth with dark glasses outside my door.
Right now, yeah. And I want to invite the members of the FBI and the NSA and all the various agencies that are now listening to Action Radio. Thank you for joining us. I do that every once in a while. And we're not going to finish this article. So again, in about a minute and a half, I'll get to the conclusions just so we get those in. It says the actual impact of the Boeing 767 on 9/11 was 96% of the design specifications, which indicates that the main structure, and it's overbuilt. It's built many, you know, 10 times, it's built to handle stresses 10 times the actual specs, right? This was less than the actual specs, all right, 96% of them, which indicates that the main structure at this height could have been damaged. The exact amount of damage is not easy to determine, but by screening eyewitnesses' statements, it is possible to determine the approximate amount of damage. It says in both cases, it appeared that the planes allegedly affected the main construction covering so many meters. Since local main construction did not collapse under this impact, energy means that the main structure was able to handle on floors 81 and 95 at least the formula again. This was calculated during the calculated duration of the impact. This equals another thing. All right. So in other words, they're resistant. With these two impacts, it is possible to determine the course. And they got a graphic analysis of the minimum impact resistance. This is too much math. I'm going to get away from this stuff. Let's get into fireproof. The towers are designed to handle a theoretical fire load of 220 megajoules per meter squared per hour. The towers are constructed to handle this amount of energy spread during 4 hours. Okay, when a fire becomes hot enough, almost anything starts to burn, from paint to even aluminum. And then it got, this is an average office contains, you know, so much combustible material. The kerosene, this is where we get to the jet fuel argument, must have burned in less than 2 minutes, and that's an estimation, meaning that the permissible fire load of the towers could have been exceeded during the time the kerosene caught fire over 6 floors. That's not the whole building, folks. That's 6 floors. With a short fire load of maximum da-da-da-da, the overload would be approximately 920%, assuming that all the kerosene burned inside the towers. But since a part of the kerosene exploded outside the towers, means that it was less. And the question is, how much less? They don't know. The volume of the fireball around Tower 1 during the hit was another mathematical formula. The fireball could freely expand since the windows were already blown out. So in other words, how much of the fireball exploded out and how much actually affected the building? There's another problem. This means that they say around 5% of the kerosene burned inside the tower. 5% of the kerosene burned inside the tower. And that's at the top floors. We're not even talking about the bottom of the building. And says because only 5% of the kerosene burned inside the towers means that the fire load was not more than 240 during less than 2 minutes. The towers were able to handle this amount of energy easily. They were designed on this fire load, not just for 2 minutes, but during 4 hours. So much for the
well,
kerosene.
See another thing too. Mm-hmm. Those floors are sealed where the columns penetrate in order to prevent a chimney effect.
Yeah.
You know what the chimney effect is, right?
Chimney effect. Where?
I don't.
Explain it real quickly, and then I'll get to the conclusions because we're almost out of time.
Well, chimney effect, you have to have air that the hot air travels up, and so the floors are sealed where the columns that penetrated in order to prevent it. So a lot of this theory is crazy.
Yeah. Tom, from your fire experience, do fires burn up or do they burn down?
They burn up.
So an airplane crashing on the 85th and 91st floors would tend to cause the fire to go to the top of the building? Not the bottom? Does that sound a little... go ahead.
That's in my brain.
Okay. So how'd they collapse? All right, let me get to the conclusion right away. Josie, real quick, or whoever wants to make a comment real fast.
No,
okay.
I don't have a comment.
All right.
At the moment.
So here are the conclusions. We can go back and poke around this for a couple of minutes, but it says conclusion. Why did the Twin Towers collapse? There are a few consistent conclusions to make. The towers were designed to handle the airplane impact, the heat, and the fire load, but this doesn't prove they were actually capable to withstand an impact. It's a mere indication. It says 95% of the energy to weaken the structure enough to cause full collapse was not available. But the main structure collapsed in both cases. Why? Next bullet point. The 12-floor block of Tower 1 must have stopped to drop 2.8 meters. And we'll talk about drops another day. Below floor 92, but it didn't. There's no reason why it should continue to drop, for the main structure was tough enough to absorb the energy of the 12-floor falling block. I'll explain that in a minute. The main structure below floor 92 was fully intact able to stop the falling 12th floor block of Tower 1. Technically speaking, Tower 1 should have been around 25 meters, 82 feet shorter. Buckling was not an option, as I show with mathematics above. So why did the towers collapse? Regarding from a technical perspective, this was impossible without adding another energy source to it. The aluminum of the airplane contained too less energy to cause a meltdown of the construction, whatever source might claim about this. It is nonsense. Furthermore, was the construction strong enough to stop the falling 12-floor block, as mathematically proves? How much energy was necessary to make the towers collapse? The absolute minimum, and it says here the amount of energy to make this collapse is an unimaginable amount of energy, which equals the energy of over 200 thunderbolts. All right. Speculation of the Russians that a small nuclear device was detonated in the core seems to be not unthinkable, especially because natural collapse was impossible. The intense heat of 4,000 degrees centigrade of a nuclear device is enough to bypass the thermal isolation in an instant flash over full height. We're almost done. The result, a full collapse like a house of cards, allegedly caused by airplane impacts operated by bearded goat herders. Of course, that sounds likely that so many believe this says something about the current human condition. All right. So other sources speak of thermite, which is what Bianchi mentioned, and even thermane, which is even more viscous than thermite. This is also possible. But what is impossible is that these buildings collapsed under their own weight. It was a well-calculated and orchestrated action. We all know what happened after 9/11, and this is George Orwell's 1984 started to unfold. So when we get into this article again, I'll get to more details on the buckling and some of the other things. But what they're saying is, what the author says, is that something like thermite or some incredible heat source at the base melted the structure in a way that brought it down. It was not the airplanes.
It was from the top down. It only makes sense. The steel at the top, those two floors could have probably been brought out on four trucks. But down at the bottom, one piece was probably brought out on one truck because of its weight.
Yeah. Well, what the article goes into that I didn't have time to get to today is that even if the airplane had weakened those floors, they would have collapsed about, you know, maybe 10 floors down. But it would not have brought down the buildings. Anyway, thank you all for a great discussion, Tom. We got to go. Guys, we're out of time. We're done. Bianchi, Josie, Gene, Tom, thanks for joining us. Greg, all right, we'll do it again tomorrow. Yeah, Greg found us for Action Radio at blogtalkradio.com/citizenaction. We are not done with this topic. Anyway, support us at patreon.com/actionradio and share our show, please. And if you want to listen to us while you're driving, just put Action Radio into your phone, connect that to the car audio, and there we are. I'll be back tomorrow, 7 o'clock in the morning, Central Time.